So we're looking this morning at Matthew's Gospel, chapter 9, verses 14 to 26. Now often at the start of a sermon, I warn you that we're going to spend longer on the first point than we are on the others. It's so that when I eventually do move on to the second point, you don't panic, thinking that we're only a third of the way through the sermon. Well, this morning, the first point isn't, I think, going to be particularly long, but I do need to issue a different kind of advance warning, and it's this. The first point doesn't actually relate directly to our passage. The initial part of our sermon this morning, it's going to be a kind of stepping back and a viewing of the big picture, to use a modern phrase. And only when we've done that, only when we've stepped back, only when we've surveyed the bigger picture, only then will we actually come back to Matthew 9. And so our first heading then this morning is this, the story of the Bible. The story of the Bible. So a year ago we were in the early chapters of this gospel, and I kept emphasizing then the Bible's storyline and how the Bible's storyline is really about two men, Adam and Jesus. And Adam then was a king. That's clear from Genesis chapter 1. God gave him this role to exercise dominion, to reign, to be a king. And briefly then, he fulfilled that role. But sadly, of course, it didn't last. King Adam messed up spectacularly. And in so doing, he plunged this world into misery. But amazingly, God didn't walk away from the situation in disgust. Instead, many centuries later, he sent Jesus into the world to be a new Adam. And like the first Adam, Jesus was a king. But lightning didn't strike twice. King Jesus didn't mess up. He succeeded where King Adam failed, and wonderfully, he put everything right again. And the early chapters of Matthew, of course, describe Jesus' arrival into the world. And as they do so, they kind of constantly, just beneath the surface, there is this King Adam, King Jesus parallel going on. And so that's why a year ago I kept emphasizing that basic, no-frills version of the Bible's storyline. What I want to do now is add another layer to it. Because you see, Adam wasn't just a king. He also had another role. He was a bridegroom. In Genesis 2, that's made clear. There God presents Adam with a bride. And as you leave the book of Genesis then, it's a logical inference for the reader to make that if the Messiah is going to be a new Adam, then like the first one, he too will be a bridegroom. And sure enough, as the rest of the Old Testament unfolds and as it looks forward to God's coming salvation, it strikes precisely that matrimonial note. It looks forward to a wedding. God will present to the new Adam a bride, just as once he presented to the first Adam a bride. In this case, however, the bride will have a corporate dimension. It will be God's people as a whole. And this wedding then will be resoundingly joyful. Joyful mainly because it will be these two lovers, the Messiah and his people, coming together in intimate union, never again to be separated. That was the emphasis, wasn't it, in that Old Testament passage I read? Psalm 45. It's a passage that is looking forward to this great wedding. And it captures so well, doesn't it, the mutual excitement of the bride and the groom. She, for her part, entering the room, verse 15, with joy and gladness. You can kind of picture the beaming smile on her face. It's that line in Stuart Townend's hymn, "The bride will run to her lover's arms." That's what's going on there in Psalm 45. And he, for his part, seeing her grand entrance into the room, desires her beauty, verse 11 of the psalm. And so the wedding will be joyful above all else as the coming together of bride and groom, but joyful too because of the venue. This is the emphasis in another Old Testament passage which we didn't have time to read this morning, but it's Hosea chapter 2, verses 16 to 20. I'm just going to quickly read those verses now. Hosea 2, verse 16, "In that day declares the Lord, you," that's my people, "will call me my husband. For I will remove the names of the Baals from your mouth, they shall be remembered no more. And I will make for them a covenant on that day with the beasts of the field, the birds of the heavens, and the creeping things of the ground. And I will abolish the bow, the sword, and war from the land. And I will make you lie down in safety. And I will betroth you to me forever. I will betroth you to me in righteousness and in justice, in steadfast love and in mercy. I will betroth you to me in faithfulness, and you shall know the Lord." So here too, the great future wedding is being anticipated. You can see, can't you, the marriage language there at the beginning and at the end of that section I just read. But sandwiched between the marriage language, in verse 18 of that passage, is this focus on the creation. And particularly on the nasty things within the creation being removed. What's that about? Well, when Ken and Sarah got married in this building, when James and Elspeth got married in this building, what did we do? Well, we had a Saturday morning clean-up session beforehand, didn't we? To remove the weeds and the litter from outside, to remove the cobwebs and the carpet stains from inside. We brought the venue up to scratch. On a grander scale, when Harry and Meghan got married in Windsor, the whole town was given a clean-up, wasn't it? To the extent that, controversially, the local council were proposing to kind of remove homeless people from the streets, get them out of view. They were bringing the venue up to scratch. And here in Hosea 2, we have the same thing on a vastly grander scale. Still, the entire creation is going to undergo a clean-up for the true royal wedding. Everything ugly and unsavory being chucked into the bin, because the creation is going to be the setting for this wedding of the Messiah and his people, and so the venue must be brought up to scratch. And so I'm saying then, the story of the Bible isn't simply the story of two kings, it's the story of two bridegroom kings. One who fails his bride and whose marriage quickly descends into tension and recrimination. She gave me the fruit to eat. And one who is the perfect bridegroom. You're the most handsome of the sons of men. Grace is poured upon your lips. Therefore God has blessed you forever. Psalm 45, 2. And the omega point of the story then is this joyful wedding. Joyful because the bride and groom are coming together. Joyful because the venue is all cleaned up and beautiful. And that's indeed how the Bible pretty much ends, isn't it? Its penultimate chapter, Revelation 21. There you have the wedding. And there's a focus on the intimate coming together. I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband, verse 2. And there's a focus, too, on the spruced up venue. A new heaven and a new earth, verse 1. With all the old nasty stuff gone. Death is no more, verse 4. Neither mourning, nor crying, nor pain, for the former things have passed away. And so that's the first thing. Kind of back of our text this morning, the story of the Bible. But then secondly, notice with me, the surprise with the bridegroom. The surprise with the bridegroom. So now we're ready at last to turn to our passage here in Matthew 9. And in our passage then, Jesus describes himself in a very interesting way. He describes himself as the bridegroom. Twice in verse 15, he uses that description. Now, we know, of course, that Jesus never married. He remained single throughout his life. So why then does he describe himself as the bridegroom? Well, quite clearly, he's referring to what we have just been talking about. He's saying that he's the new Adam. He's the bridegroom king, anticipated throughout the Old Testament. And that being so, if Jesus is the long-awaited bridegroom, and if Jesus is here now on earth, if he has stepped onto the stage of history, which clearly he has, surely that can only mean one thing. The great joyful wedding of Psalm 45 and Hosea 2, it has arrived. And sure enough, there are indications here in our passage that that is indeed the case. I mean, one of the themes of our passage is what I'm going to call the inappropriateness of mourning. I mean, M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G, the inappropriateness of mourning. It comes to the fore, first of all, in this encounter Jesus has with John the Baptist's disciples. And they've noticed that Jesus' disciples don't fast. And they themselves are very into fasting, and so they raise this matter with Jesus. And it's interesting, Jesus doesn't say to them, oh, well, thanks, guys, for picking up on this. You know, I'll look into it. And if you're right, if my lot aren't fasting, then I'll really give them a flea in their ear next time I see them. He doesn't respond like that. Instead, he dismisses the whole idea of them fasting as ludicrous. He dismisses the whole idea of them fasting as inappropriate. Mourning, he says, is inappropriate. Why is it inappropriate? Well, because it's the wedding. The imagery here changes slightly from other Bible passages, and instead of a bride, we have wedding guests. But the point is the same. Jesus has come, and he's with his people. That's the crucial preposition there in verse 15. The bridegroom is with them, and so it's no time for mourning. Just as it's inappropriate, he says, to combine an old garment with a piece of new unshrunk cloth, verse 16. Just as it's appropriate to combine old wineskins with new wine, verse 17. So it's inappropriate to combine the mourning of former times with the wedding day and the joyful coming together of Jesus and his people that is now taking place. So that's the encounter with John the Baptist's disciples. And then this inappropriateness of mourning, it comes to the fore secondly as Jesus arrives at the house of this bereaved ruler. The man's daughter has died. And at the house then there's this extravagant outpouring of grief that's going on. Matthew calls it a commotion in verse 23. And encountering this scene, Jesus does a very strange thing. He doesn't join in the weeping and the wailing. He doesn't even bow his head respectfully for a moment, as we British might do in such circumstances. No, this is what he does. He tells the mourners to get lost. That's basically what he does. Go away, he says. It's a little bit reminiscent of that day that he passed through the town of Nain, and he came across a funeral procession there. A woman's only son had died. What does he do? He goes right up to that heartbroken woman and says, do not weep. And you think, what's going on these occasions? What's going on there in Luke 7? What's going on here in Matthew 9? What is this insensitivity in the heart of Jesus? How can Jesus possibly expect people to be dry-eyed and chirpy when death has just struck? Well, because with his presence, the bridegroom is here. And so they should know it's the wedding day. And the venue now has to be made ready, which means that all nasty things have to go, which means death has to go. The widow of Nain's son can't stay dead. The little girl here can't stay dead because it's time for the marriage of the Messiah and his people. And so the creation has to be cleaned up of all its mess, cleaned up of debilitating health problems like that of the bleeding woman in verse 20, cleaned up of death. That's why these flute players at the house need to quit their songs of lamentation and make themselves scarce. And so I'm saying there's this unmistakable sense in our passage that the great joyful wedding has arrived. It comes across especially, as I've been saying, in this inappropriateness of mourning motif. But not just in that, it comes across in more subtle ways too. I think at a couple of points Matthew is alluding in a very understated manner to that passage we read, Psalm 45. It's interesting that in that psalm, the bridegroom on his wedding day has on these robes from which is emanating this glorious aroma of myrrh and other spices, verse 8 of the psalm. And here in our passage then, as Jesus makes his way to this house, there's an emphasis, isn't there, on his garment. And it's the same word in the Greek version that's in the Greek version of Psalm 45, a translated robe, garment, here in our passage. And from Jesus' garment is emanating this glorious healing power, a bit like the spices there of the bridegroom in Psalm 45, this healing power that dispels the woman's bleeding. So there's an interesting parallel there at the level of robes, garments, from which healing and beauty is coming. Then again, in the psalm, the bridegroom on his wedding day has at his side these female companions who are described as the daughters of kings, verse 9 of the psalm. And here in our passage, who is this girl that Jesus raises from the dead? Well, she's the daughter of a ruler. Matthew doesn't call him, as Mark and Luke do, a synagogue ruler. He calls him just a ruler, perhaps to maximize that connection with Psalm 45. So by the end of this passage, Jesus has by his side this female, this girl, holding his hand, who is the daughter of a ruler. And these little echoes then of the psalm, the robes and the daughters of kings, they are further indications, I'm saying, that the wedding day anticipated in the Old Testament has now arrived. However, it's at this point that I need to throw a rather big spanner in the works. Because despite everything I've been saying over the last few minutes, what we actually have as Jesus comes to this earth and as he steps onto the stage of history, what we actually have isn't the long anticipated wedding. What we actually have is something more like a wedding rehearsal. Some of you have been at a wedding rehearsal, perhaps on the evening before the wedding that you were taking part in some capacity. And what happens at a wedding rehearsal? Well, you get a glimpse, don't you, of the wedding itself. So the bridegroom will stand at the front of the church building and the bride will practice walking down the aisle and will take her place beside him. And it's a glimpse then of the couple coming together and being joined permanently in intimate union to one another. But it's only a glimpse. And after an hour or so of the rehearsal will end. And the bride and groom will leave that church building and they'll go their separate ways to spend the night in separate places, sleeping in separate beds. And similarly then, Jesus' presence on earth here in the Gospels with his bride It's a glimpse of the permanent coming together. But it's only a glimpse. The rehearsal's going to end. That's what Jesus says in verse 15, isn't it? That the bridegroom, now with them, is going to be taken away from them. There's going to be this going of separate ways. Or think of the church building itself at a wedding rehearsal, the venue. And those responsible for decorating it with flowers and ribbons and all the rest of it, they've done a bit of that already by the time of the rehearsal. And so again, the rehearsal is a glimpse of how the venue will look for the wedding itself the next day. But again, it's only a glimpse, because it's the next morning that most of the decoration will be done. And similarly then, when Jesus removes this woman's discharge of blood, and when he removes death from this girl, it's a glimpse of how the venue will look for the wedding itself. It's a glimpse of the creation properly cleaned up, as it will be for the marriage when the marriage actually takes place. But it's only a glimpse. And the healed woman will soon get another illness, and eventually she'll die. And the little girl will live for however many years or decades, and she will again sink into death. So yes, the bridegroom of Psalm 45 has arrived, that's true. But the permanent coming together anticipated in Psalm 45 hasn't yet arrived. Yes, the bridegroom of Hosea 2 has arrived, that's true. But the fully spruced up wedding venue anticipated in Hosea 2 hasn't yet arrived. And this then is the surprise that I'm referring to in my second heading this morning. Because you see, the Old Testament passages, they gave little indication that the bridegroom would appear twice. That before his appearance for the actual wedding itself, he would make a pre-wedding appearance in which there would be tantalizing glimpses of the real thing, but not yet the real thing. And it raises the question then, why? Why does he do this? I mean, I've been using the analogy just now of a wedding rehearsal. But of course, Jesus doesn't really need a rehearsal for the great wedding that's going to happen at the end of time. We need wedding rehearsals because otherwise we might stand in the wrong position and we might fluff our lines or all kinds of things might go wrong. But Jesus isn't going to make mistakes like that. No. Although, like a wedding rehearsal, in the ways I've described, this pre-wedding appearance of the bridegroom Jesus here, it really has a different function. And it's a function, actually, that is strongly hinted in our passage itself. I've already mentioned verse 15, and that reference to the bridegroom being taken away. But it's actually more sinister than it sounds in our English versions. The verb taken away there, it's quite a strong and a violent verb even. More than that, it's a verb that seems to be echoing another Old Testament passage, an Old Testament passage with which we're more familiar, Isaiah chapter 53. And in Isaiah 53, and verse 8, this is what is said of the Messiah. By oppression and judgment, he was taken away. And it's virtually the same verb in the Greek version as we have here in Matthew 9:15. What's Isaiah 53 talking about? Well, it's talking about the cross. It's talking about Jesus' bloody, violent death. You see, this bridegroom Jesus, he's in a situation a little bit like another biblical bridegroom, Boaz, there in the book of Ruth. And remember how in that book you follow this developing relationship between Boaz and Ruth. And we get to the point where everything seems to be set up for them to get married. And Ruth has made her intentions clear to him, and he has made his intentions clear to her. And it seems like they can just go ahead and get married, but they can't yet. Because there's a problem that first of all needs to be resolved. Boaz, the bridegroom, has to deal with a problem before the wedding can go ahead. He has to play the role of redeemer, and he has to solve that problem. He has to deal with that competing claim upon Ruth. And it's somewhat similar here. Before the bridegroom Jesus can wed his bride, us, the people of God, he has to deal with a problem. He has to assume the role of a redeemer and deal with the problem. What's the problem? Well, the problem is that we, the bride, are guilty. And on the very day that we should be marrying the bridegroom, at the end of time there, instead, we are due to be chucked into jail that day, condemned to punishment, everlasting imprisonment in hell that day. That's the problem. And the purpose then of Jesus' pre-wedding appearance, the purpose of him coming as the bridegroom, yet not on this occasion to actually marry his bride, the purpose was to deal with that problem and to deal with it by taking his bride's place and going to prison for her and going to hell for her and on the cross paying himself for her guilt. And so that's why there's this surprise, which the Old Testament never really foresaw. The Old Testament foresaw a single coming of the bridegroom to wed his bride. But we come to the New Testament, and the bridegroom has emerged, but it's not yet the wedding. The bridegroom has come first to deal with the problem, first to be redeemer, first to go to the cross, first to pay for his bride's guilt, so that there can be another appearing later in which the wedding itself can occur. So we've seen then this morning the story of the Bible, and we've seen the surprise with the bridegroom. But then thirdly and finally, the significance to the believer. The significance to the believer. What does all this mean then for us this morning? How can we apply it? Well, I guess most basically the significance to us is this, that we should be looking forward to that great joyful wedding. The joyful wedding anticipated in prophetic texts throughout the Old Testament. Glimpse then, so tantalizingly, in the first appearing of the bridegroom, but still to come at a future as yet unknown date. We should be looking forward to that. We all lament, don't we, the undermining of marriage that has been going on in our society over recent years and decades. The change of legislation, the introduction of same-sex marriage, the loosening of divorce laws, and all the rest of it. And sometimes, perhaps in our darker moments, we think, well, perhaps this great institution is just going to go extinct. It's not. History is going to end in a marriage. Doesn't mean we shouldn't lament what's going on. Doesn't mean we shouldn't fight for marriage. Indeed, we should be given additional impetus in that fight by the dignity conferred on marriage by this great prospect of a future wedding. We have a higher motive for valuing marriage than merely the stability of society, merely the conducive environment for the raising of children. There is a marriage with which history is going to end. So, yes, we should lament, we should fight, but we shouldn't think marriage is going to go under. All of history is inexorably building up to a marriage. History is not going to end with the human race wiped out by some apocalyptic disaster, some meteorite blasting us into smithereens. History is going to end with the warmth and the celebration and the festivity and the joy of a marriage, a wedding. That's how history is going to end. And so we should be looking forward to that. But another application here. A degree of mourning is appropriate for us as Christians. I mean, that's what Jesus says, isn't it, here? He says that in verse 15, the days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them, and then they will fast. And I don't think he's simply referring there to Passion Weekend and Good Friday particularly, and Saturday, when Jesus had been taken away briefly prior to then re-emerging in his resurrection. He's talking here more about his return to heaven. And he's saying then fasting will be appropriate. That's why in a couple of chapters earlier, in chapter 6, Jesus has taught his disciples about fasting. So he does intend his disciples to fast. He does intend Christians to do that. In fact, here perhaps we're being given an additional reason for doing so. When I preached on that fasting text in Matthew 6, I talked about two reasons that might underlie fasting. Number one, that prayer sometimes is so important that ordinary routines like eating meals have to go out the window. And number two, fasting can be a helpful break on our idolatrous dependencies. And fasts can remind us that we're only dependent on Christ. We're not dependent on this particular food, this particular drink, coffee, chocolate, whatever it might be, but only dependent upon Christ. But here now is a third reason why we might fast, why we should mourn as believers, a more pervasive one, because the wedding hasn't yet happened. And we should mourn then as Christians because the wedding venue is still so obviously unready. Illness and disease and death still plague this world. The cleanup hasn't yet happened. The world is still filthy with the curse that came down in Genesis 3. The wedding venue is emphatically, unmistakably still unready. And we should mourn because of that. Mourn the problems, the crises, the trials that plague our lives in the present. But most of all, we should mourn because the coming together of bride and groom has not yet happened. I mean, think about our worship this morning. Often in evangelical terminology, you hear worship services being described in a particular way these days. Celebration. Worship is a celebration. And there's obviously truth in that. And I preached from Judges last year on Deborah's song and how it was a song of victory. And I said, why do we sing? We sing because we're celebrating the victory that Christ has won at the cross. And so, yes, we are celebrating when we gather like this. But that's not the whole story, is it? Should there not also always, at times like this, be a slight sense of disappointment? That here we are, communing with Christ, and he's invisible. And all we've got is a book and some lumps of bread and some glasses of wine. And that's how the relationship is conducted. We want more than that, don't we? We want to see him. We want to be in his immediate presence. We don't want to be confined forever to these means of grace, thankful though we are for them, and they are means of grace, and we do commune with Christ through them, but the communion we have with him through them is so limited and so partial compared to that for which we look forward. We're sometimes too easily pleased, aren't we? Like a couple deciding that, you know, we're not going to get married after all. We're going to cancel the wedding and we're not going to live in the same address because we've got Skype and we've got FaceTime. And that's enough. And we can be like that as Christians. We you know, we have these celebrations. We have the presence of Christ. Paul smashes through that with one extraordinary statement in 2 Corinthians 5 verse 6. This is how he describes the present relationship between us and Christ. He says, we are away from the Lord. That's what he says. You think, but Paul, didn't you hear what Jesus said at the end of his life on earth as he was ascending into heaven? I am with you always. Paul, don't you have a properly developed theology of worship? That we're communing with Christ when we come together? We are away from the Lord, he says. Faith hasn't yet turned to sight. And that's what we long for. Oh, to long for it more, to desire with a passion that almost can't wait any longer for that day when the wedding, glimpsed in Christ's first appearing, will occur with his second appearing. May God give us that burning desire. Amen.